to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM, and for some reason I am echoing here, and I can't figure out see if that works okay.
And I can hear you now.
Okay. All right. Well, let me go ahead, and I'm introducing the program here. This is Truth Quest with Melody, and you're on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, and we're streamed on the internet at khen.org, and TruthQuest programs are archived at www.gimmesometruth.info. And this evening, I've got Dan, who's kind of be sitting in monitoring and in training for to be another DJ here at the station, but we're also having a membership drive, and I want to welcome everybody. I've got a special guest, James Rogers Brown, and we'll introduce him in just a minute, but I also want to state that, let's see, we've met $2,680 of our goal for the membership. And I think it'll be going on through this Saturday. So we've got 22 new members and 20 renewing members. I want to thank everybody for joining in that has joined and rejoined our membership. And let's see here. What else? We have a matching challenge fund. Free the Monkey Consignment is challenging other local businesses to become a to become member supporters of KHEN Free Range Radio. What that means is if you are a business, local, or otherwise, and you call to pledge, and unfortunately, during this talk program, we're not going to be able to take phone calls, but what we do have is we have people here answering the phone in the morning, and we should have them throughout the day, but Magda will come in, and she'll be here to take the phone calls at 539-1069. But your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar by Free the Monkey Consignment right here in downtown Salida on F Street. So become a new or renewing member and help support your one and only community radio station powered by your friends and neighbors. And again, call 539-1069 or check us out on the web at khen.org and pledge through PayPal or stop by. Again, Free the Monkey Consignment is offering a matching challenge fund valued at $106.90. And if you're a business, here's your chance to double your contribution to KHEN. Call us at 539-1069, and we want to thank Emily down at Free the Monkey for offering this matching challenge fund during our spring membership drive. It's because of your support that KHEN continues to thrive. And I want to state that the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And James Roger Brown is a sociology of knowledge specialist in intelligence collection and analysis methodologist. Boy, that's kind of a little bit of a mouthful there, but
that's easy for you to say.
It is. And he has developed the only existing objective criteria-based definition of the best interest of the child and serves as a consultant and expert witness on detecting and documenting organized crime methods and procedures integrated into government child protection agencies and programs. Roger is a director and owner of the Sociology Center. I want to say welcome, Roger, and James. You go by James or Roger?
You can call me Roger.
Okay. Welcome, Roger. And I'm going to let you just see, you know, add to that. And if you want to, you know, go from there.
Okay. I'll let you do the answering of questions. This is a problem we're going to talk about that's based on the interaction of political extremists and white-collar criminals that have virtually gained control of the child protection system. I'm going to read you some quotes and see if you can identify who said them. The first one, under patriarchy, every woman is a victim, past, present, and future. Under patriarchy, every woman's daughter is a victim, past, present, and future. Under patriarchy, every woman's son is her potential betrayer and also the inevitable rapist or exploiter of another woman. That's quote one from this person. The second quote is, the cultural institutions which embody and enforce those interlocked aberrations, for instance, law, art, religion, nation states, the family, tribe, or commune based on father right, these institutions are real and they must be destroyed. If they are not, we will be consigned as women to perpetual inferiority and subjugation. Do you have any idea who said that?
No, I don't.
Her name is Andrea Dworkin. And one of her books is The Root Cause, Our Blood, Prophecies, and Discourse on Sexual Politics, published in 1995. She is important because she was the ideologist responsible for the most extreme feminist politics that were anti-male and anti-family. That took root in the social work profession, and in a series of social work conventions in the 1973 to 75 time period, a number of them started colluding on ways to carry out their anti-male and anti-family agenda through social work services, and these are the people that first started setting up the child protection system. Now, I'm going to read you a couple of more quotes and link in the other extremist enterprises. What is the use of Americans if they bring no money? They are not good for anything else. America is useful for nothing else but to supply money. Is it not sad that we are materially dependent on those savages who are not better class human beings? Quote one. Quote two, in the depths of my heart, I can't help being convinced that my dear fellow men, with few exceptions, are worthless. I have found little that is good about human beings on the whole. In my experience, most of them are trash, no matter whether they publicly subscribe to this or that ethical doctrine or to none at all. Do you have a clue who the great humanitarian was who uttered those words?
No, I don't, again.
Sigmund Freud.
Wow.
He was a supporter of the Nazis until Hitler turned on the Jews. But those attitudes migrated with his supporters and himself to the United States, and they were clever enough to get into central power positions in universities and other educational agencies to further their agendas of gaining control and essentially finding ways to make money exploiting Americans. That's literally what they thought. What is the use of Americans if they bring no money? They are not good for anything else. And the end result of that, I'll get to toward the end of this, but they essentially set up an organized crime operation using psychological testing rigged to produce false positives. There are tests such as the MMPI-2 that are rigged to produce false positives. If you take that test, there is literally no way for you to for your answers to be interpreted as indicating you have no psychological disorders. The only purpose of that test is to determine which psychological disorder or disorders you have, not whether or not you have none. Okay?
Okay.
And I'll get into how that works later. Starting with the one story that pretty much demonstrates the scope and magnitude of how the fraud structure works. In Florida, there was a child named Rilia Wilson, and she was missing out of the child protection system and apparently kidnapped by someone familiar with the inner workings of the child protection system. She was in foster care, and someone showed up at the foster parent's house with a letter, and it contained the department letterhead, so she thought it was legitimate. The letter indicated they were to take the child for a dental appointment. Well, the child was never returned, and for 17 months, the caseworkers falsified reports that she was in the home doing fine, despite the fact that the foster parent repeatedly told them that the child had never been returned. Their instructions to her were to keep cashing the checks she was getting for taking care of the child. Finally, when they could no longer, you know, pull off the charade, they had to inform the police that the child was missing.
Okay, now before we get too far into this, I know we gave a little bit of your background, but I'd kind of like to find out why you're doing what you're doing and why we're going where we're going. And
okay, I became aware of this problem through personal experience. I was falsely accused of molesting my daughter in an ugly divorce, and I watched the court-appointed social worker, court-appointed psychologist, lie their behinds off on a witness stand with such outlandish propositions that I was able to somehow convince my then wife to leave home 12 years before I met her. And that was accepted by the judge as something I had done. And I had to determine how they were able to do that. So I started analyzing the interpretive structure for the MMPI-2, and I reverse engineered all of the methods used to rig the test to produce false positives.
Now, was there something that indicated to you that that was the test that was causing this sort of thing to come about?
Well, it was because of the conclusions that were reached, allegedly describing my personality, which absolutely did not match reality. So that's one of the reasons why I said I had to figure out how they did it. At that time, I had completed my master's degree and my master's thesis was a cross-national study of intelligence operations in World War II. I was in the process of developing sophisticated intelligence collection and analysis methodology to improve what the government was using. I did this on my own. I was not employed by the government, and I've refused all offers to work for intelligence agencies.
Okay, now when they were, you're saying that the government was using, how are they using it?
Well, the methods used by the NSA, National Security Agency, Central Intelligence Agency, the Office of Naval Intelligence, Criminal Investigation Division, you know, all of the alphabet agencies, including such obscure offices as the National Reconnaissance Office. You know, literally there are agencies that people know about, and there's others that their existence is completely classified, and nobody in the public even knows what their names are. That's what I'm talking about when I refer to intelligence collection and analysis methodology.
So what you're saying is there's something that just so happened that you were already studying things that might have been somewhat related?
Well, I had developed the tools for finding the truth when people were attempting to conceal the truth. And I was using those methodologies to analyze what was going on in the child protection, mental health, and social work systems. And after about 12 years of research, a congressman in California, Joe Baca, decided to hold public hearings and called for evidence books, congressional evidence books, which have to be produced in a specific format with specific types of information in them. And I took all of the research I had done on organized crime and organized science fraud in the child protection, mental health, and social work systems, turned it into a congressional evidence book, which you can actually download in its entirety from my website, which is www.thesociologycenter.com. And if you go to Special Research Projects, and then on that page, Child Slave Trade Project, you will find all of the information, including other congressional evidence books that were turned over for Joe Baca's hearings. Now, mine eventually was forwarded to the Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives, and for several years they had my cover letter on their website, but that's all been removed. I think it was last year they made it major revisions in their official website and removed a lot of material. Mine was among them. But you still can download the congressional evidence book from my website.
Okay, so I guess I'm trying to get the time frame set up here. Was this incident that took place that you're through your divorce before or after you'd done this?
It was after I got my master's thesis. And in fact, at the time I was working on a PhD in social policy analysis, which I was not able to complete because the program was interdisciplinary and the two divisions of the school that were supposedly joint administering it got to fighting and destroyed the program before I got out. But I completed everything but the dissertation for that. The divorce occurred in the early 80s.
Okay.
And, you know, my experience and the outrageous accusations that were made against me and how they were sustained were what first made me aware that there was a problem. At the time, I had no idea what the heck was going on. But I had the tools from doing the intelligence, related master's thesis again, which was a cross-national study of intelligence operations in World War II conducted by Britain, the United States, Germany, and Russia. And the result of that was that I identified the social determinants of success or failure in intelligence operations. And if you're interested in that, that's available on my website, too, under the Internet Bibliography page.
Okay.
I've tried to put as much information on my website as possible, although it's primarily business-oriented. There's a publication shopping cart that has the book I wrote, which is the only manual for doing an objective child abuse investigation that has ever been developed. Sociology Center Practical Guide to Determining the Best Interest of the Child.
Now, do you think that there's any reason why that yours is the only book developed? Does that kind of make you
yes,
wonder?
It's because of the money that's being made from the fraud and organized crime that's currently driving the system. One of the divisions in my congressional evidence book is the love of conditional federal funding is the root of all government evil. Excuse me. The love of conditional federal funding is the root of all government evil. And I say that because all of the problems that have developed in the child protection system are because the agencies are paid from conditional federal funding and federal grant and reimbursement programs. And I can give you some examples. The way it works from start to finish is the agency, the Child Protection Service agency, has to participate in the budget planning process. And part of doing that is they estimate how much money they're going to need from state funds and how much money they're going to need and can obtain from federal funds, which are either grants or reimbursements. And the way the reimbursements work are the agency expends state funds for whatever, and then filling out the paperwork properly, they apply for reimbursement of those expenditures from federal funds. Now, among those funds are the funds that are pay the salaries of the caseworkers. And the first problem that develops is that once those budget estimates are made, they turn into budget goals in this way that the agency cannot balance its payroll then if they don't get the federal funds they're anticipating and have budgeted receiving. 58% of the caseworkers who investigate child abuse allegations, 58% of their annual salary comes from federal salary reimbursement funds at the rate of about $2,238, I think it was 43 cents per child per year. So they have to take into custody enough children every year with that average value in, you know, literally their bounty placed on the child's head, and they have to take in enough to get 58% of their paycheck from the federal funds. If they do not, It's like working in a used car lot and not meeting your quota. You know, if you don't meet your quota, somebody else has got to pick up the dead weight, and you know, you're not going to stay around long.
Okay,
so,
now, but this funding system is pretty much rampant in much of the government agencies.
I'm sorry, but I can't hear you.
Now, this kind of funding is pretty much rampant in a lot of the government agencies, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
But it's particularly odious in the child protection system because it ends up placing a bounty on all of the children. The other side of this is that there's basically a quota and commission system that both apply to the funds generated from the children. The agencies themselves used to hire people to fill out the federal paperwork to get the grant and reimbursement funds, but it became so complex that they started contracting it out to third parties. Well, those annual contracts have provisions that the contractor must, they are paid a percentage of the increase in federal funds obtained per child per year over the previous year's contract. And these contracts are renewed annually. If they do not produce an increase in revenue over the previous year, they're penalized, they're not paid, and if they persist in not meeting their goal, you know, their contracted goal, then their contract is canceled and they hire somebody else who will get it done.
So then there is no program, although I could see that perverted as well. It just, you know, I mean, if somebody wants to break the rules, they can find a way to break the or pervert the rules. They can do this, but there's no incentive for trying to get those children back into a back with their parents. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. A child in parental custody is making no money for the state. You know, putting it another way, these children are bringing revenue into the state economy. They would not otherwise be there. You know, if they left the children in parental custody, and, you know, even if there was a problem, instead of working with the parents to find the solution to the problem, you know, through counseling or behavior modification or whatever, that generates no federal funds for the state. And it's gotten to such amounts of money that it's literally in the billions of dollars per year that's pulled into state economies on the backs of these children taken into custody. And there are a number of horror stories like the Relia Wilson case. There was a case, I think, in Delaware or New Jersey where a caseworker somehow got custody of an infant, and the infant died in their basement, duct taped into a high chair.
Hi.
You know, so you can find horror stories by the scores like that. In part, it's because, you know, decent people will not want to remove a child from somebody's parental custody just for money.
All right, okay. This is, by the way, this is Dan. He's training. Okay.
Well, if anybody there in the studio has questions, I will consider them as substitutes for the audience calling in.
Well, I certainly will join in. What I would like to know is, you know, when you were getting into this Wilson case, and give us some more examples of some of these cases where the abuse and why it is so necessary to be paying attention to this particular thing. I mean, because this kind of ties in with some of the prior interviews that I've done with Jim Rothstein and Ted Gunderson, and I'm trying to think of another person that I know that, John DeCamp, over some of these child trafficking situations, and why when they started looking into the situation with it, that they found that there wasn't any response from the people that should have been in official higher positions. They fell on deaf ears, or they got buried and stonewalled.
Well, there one of the most sophisticated examples I would say would be Arkansas at one time was a hub, essentially, for child trafficking, because there were one or two lawyers in the state who essentially would take orders for children, and then working with contacts inside the agency would either obtain a child from Arkansas or other states through links with some of these social workers or case workers had with other states. There was one case in which a mother with two children, one of which had been put into the Florida child protection system and then returned to her custody with monitoring. She moved to Arkansas, and Florida, just with a simple telephone call to one of the Arkansas caseworkers, got the other child seized and spirited out of the how they do this is they take the child on Friday so that there's no time for a lawyer to go to court and get any kind of order. They use Saturday and Sunday to spirit the child out of the state so that by Monday morning, even if somebody does find a sympathetic judge to issue an injunction, the child is already out of the judicial
the jurisdiction?
Territory.
Okay.
And in this case, the child was taken to Memphis, and then the Arkansas caseworker who transported the child across the state line to Tennessee met with the Florida caseworker, and the child was turned over to Florida custody. A judge subsequently ruled that it was an illegal transaction, but there wasn't anything that could be done with the order because the child was no longer within Arkansas jurisdiction.
So let me go ahead before we go any further. I want to mention, get Dan here in the room to bring up something about our membership drive. And Dan, do you want to go ahead and?
Sure. You're tuned into your one and only free range community radio station, KHEN. Our membership drive is now underway. If you want to continue hearing the unique kind of programming that only KHEN can deliver, we need your help. By becoming a new KHEN member or by renewing your existing membership, you help us keep Salida's only commercial free radio station alive. The station is open daily, Monday through Friday from 9 to 1. Just give us a call at 539-1069 or drop by the station. We broadcast from the alley behind the Mountain Mail. You can even go online at khen.org to sign up. We have membership levels to suit every wallet and nice tokens of appreciation, too, as a way to thank you for supporting this vital resource.
Okay, and I want to thank you, Dan. And we are trying to get new members, and we'd certainly appreciate you going online and hitting our donate button on the khen.org website. And we also have some matching grant or is it a matching grant or matching funds?
We also have a
$500 challenge from the Cahen Board of Directors. You can call now with your pledge. Well, actually, tomorrow.
Yeah, we need to call tomorrow. Yeah, call tomorrow because, unfortunately, we're using the phone line that you'd need to call in on. So.
And so whether you're a new or renewing member, you will be matched dollar for dollar by the Cahen Board of Directors. This is a great way to double your contribution to Cahen's Spring Membership Drive. In addition to all the hard volunteer time and energy that the Cahen Board of Directors provides, this is just another testimonial that our board members truly believe in and are dedicated to what we do here at Cahen Community Radio.
Okay, again, I want to thank you, Dan. And James, let's go ahead and get back into the subject of the research you found when you were falsely accused of in a divorce situation. So, James?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me add my voice to support for people to provide either direct financial support, or I don't know if you also have volunteer positions, but community radio stations are an important independent voice in the media mix, especially these days with centralized mainstream media ownership, which is highly corruptive for, you know, your ability to get reliable and timely information. So I would urge you to support your local community radio station, too.
Okay. Thank you, James.
Another section in the Congressional Evidence Book is called Harvesting Children for Conditional Federal Funding, which is what I was describing. And I even have a graph of some of the financial incentives, and these figures are from Arkansas for 1997 and 98 fiscal year. One of the federal funding programs is Title 4E, and one of the things that has to be done for that paperwork is you make a projection of how many children are going to be taken into state custody for the next quarter. And again, you know, once they're made, they become operational goals.
Can I ask you before you get into that, do they have anybody that has oversight over this to see that this isn't abused?
Well, it's fictitious oversight because I can tell you from personal experience that no politician, elected or appointed, is going to be the one to shut down the gravy train. And I can give you a specific instance in which that occurred. Arkansas had actually held public hearings in the legislature on revamping the child protection system because of the problems that had, you know, the horror stories that had made the newspapers there locally with children dying or being physically abused in facilities. And a state senator told the head of the agency, while I was sitting in the room in the audience for this hearing, he instructed him, when all of these reforms are put in place, make sure that there's no decrease in the federal funding coming into the state. So, you know, a state senator instructed the agency head to, you know, make sure that this continues on. And I think it was that year or the subsequent legislative session, there was actually a bill written by the staff of the Child Protective Agency in Arkansas, which contained a provision requiring caseworkers to deny that they had information, even if subpoenaed, regarding a child. And the only reason that that came to light and the bill never passed is it got mishandled in the processing, and a reporter at the end of the legislative session stumbled upon it, or near the end of the legislative session, and the legislator, a House member who had been duped by the agency into introducing the bill, was so embarrassed he withdrew it because he, you know, obviously had not even read it before introducing it. So, you know, the corruption is systemic, and it's actually called, the proper term for it is structural corruption, because it's built into how the system works.
Now, is that not unlike how our criminal system and justice system is working for people going through our court system?
Yeah, it's very similar, you know, because the federal government does reimburse the state for certain costs and operations, especially for taking care of federal prisoners in state facilities.
You know, and I've often wondered, too, and I don't know if this sort of thing ever takes place in the child protection, but I've heard the term, you've heard of the term dieseling, and where some of these times...
I'm sorry, what?
The term dieseling.
Dieseling.
Uh-huh, and it's where they would put some of these prisoners on a bus, and then they would run them around the country and check them into different facilities, and as though they would run up the census on these prisons, and they could easily get lost in this process when they're moving them between prison and prison. And I'm just wondering, when they can, do they move these kids from home to where the possibility of that process taking place with them?
Yes, in two ways. The children in the past have been moved from agencies to agencies, and also there's a biasing factor in the foster care program, which I'll explain in a minute. But an example of the profiteering, some states would have too many children in custody, in foster care custody, that were problem children and didn't fit well into the foster care program, they would be housed in facilities. Texas started making money hand over fist by setting up tent camps and taking in children from the Child Protective Service agencies in several states around the country, and it became a scandal in Texas, and I think they were eventually closed down.
It sounds a little bit like Sheriff Arpaio in Phoenix.
Yes, it does. Although, you know, the scandal was that, you know, these kids were being kept in tents year round instead of in some kind of reasonable permanent structure. Now, the way the problem works in the foster care system, the foster parents are a mixture of good, bad, and ugly. And the problem comes because they move the children around every few months from foster parent to foster parent to prevent permanent bonds forming. So the end result is that virtually all of the children are processed through foster care homes where they're either physically or sexually abused. I actually tracked down a number. It was a small sample of children, but they had aged out of the foster care system. I interviewed them, and every one of them, male and female, indicated that they had been physically and sexually abused, every single one of them. that aged out of the system. And there's actually a precedent for that, comparing it to the problems that developed in the Swedish, Switzerland, child protection system is called the Vertinkinder scandal. They had virtually the same type system that they first set up in the late 1800s. So there were several generations of children that went through it. I think it was around 1953. Excuse me. It was about 1953 that a public scandal developed because what they were doing with the children was actually holding auctions for farmers and industrialists to more or less bid on the kids to come work on their farms or in their factories. And again, what developed there was that the children aged out of the system with no education, no social skills, and, you know, lived essentially hopeless lives until they probably in most cases starved to death because they couldn't take care of themselves. And that's identical to what's happening in our system here, only it's a lot more sophisticated. The exploitation is more sophisticated and more diverse.
And how so?
Well, the lawyers benefit from it because they get involved. I can give you an example of that. A state senator in Arkansas named Nick Wilson sponsored legislation that would provide attorneys for children involved in divorce proceedings. Well, once, and it was using federal funds. Well, once it was passed, all they did was he divided up the money with himself and some of his cronies, and he had the misfortune of losing a power struggle with another political faction in Arkansas politics, and the best way to get rid of him was put him in prison for some criminal offense. So somebody blew the whistle to the feds on the fraud he committed. He was arrested, prosecuted. He and several of his cronies ended up in prison and lost their license to practice law.
But they didn't get rid of the problem, did they?
No, no. You know, and again, you know, the only reason it happened to him was because he lost the political struggle with somebody else who needed to make sure that he didn't come back. You know, but nobody, none of the politicians are going to shut down the gravy train produced by all of these federal funds that are available.
Now, does any of this come into effect with any of the immigrants?
Well, I do not have specific information on the percentage of immigrants that are affected, but it would not surprise me. You know, it doesn't matter to them whose child it is, as long as it's you know, sufficient to make their quotas.
Because I mean, what I'm seeing here, what you're saying, okay, there's money to be made on the state and federal level, and down to even county levels and the like. But then in my research with some of the other interviews that I've done, is that there was money being made on trafficking in these kids in over and above and outside of this parameter, right? And using them for other means of funding or a trade.
Well, one of the bits of information I have is that there is trafficking in children, taking them out of the country.
Okay, that's another
to
area
brothels in Mexico. And I was told by someone I helped get away from a motorcycle gang that that gang had been contracted to transport kids from Arkansas to Mexico for providing services in brothels. And I suspect the reason is that people so inclined would probably pay a premium for being able to slap around and abuse an American. I do not know that, from direct information, but I suspect that that's one reason for doing that, because obviously there would be with the poverty level, plenty of children locally that would be forced into this life. You do read quite often about ICE raids on sweatshops here in the United States, where foreign illegal immigrants are held in fenced or barred areas and essentially forced to work in sweatshops for I think the garment industry and mainly, at least that's what I recall reading most about. But those type of things do happen. But I think they're the manner in which they're exploited would probably be areas other than the child protection system.
Okay, so again,
Let me add one caveat here. One of the ways, and it's a major portion of the money, is the states get reimbursed for adoptions. So they would, their incentive would be to take into state custody people that would be more desirable for adoption. Illegal immigrant with four or five diseases who couldn't speak English would not be high on the list for likely adoption.
Again, in a little bit of a speculation, but I know that one of the things that when I was doing these interviews with these other gentlemen that were doing these investigations was finding out that when people were trying to do something about the trafficking, that often it was somebody at the top this type of crime was known and quashed by those who were at the top, even though they were aware of what was going at the bottom. And when once you get into one sort of crime, it kind of bled into the other avenues of criminal behaviors, anywhere from drug trafficking to
perversions
and arms trades, you name it. And so when they would be digging in one avenue, they would run across another. And unfortunately, when you start looking into the history, this stuff has gone on throughout history and has been controlled and operated from the top, and has always been, even though these people would find that they could only work within certain parameters, because again it started exposing things in people in higher places, so they each had to be careful in one form or fashion, but one allowed the other one to exist because they both fed off each other.
Yes. The incident I related about Senator, Arkansas State Senator Nick Wilson would be consistent with that. Now, traditional organized crime, the only place I've had information or that mafia-type organizations were directly involved was the Russian mob moving into the foster care, granting foster care status in California. I have not had a chance to take a look at exactly how that corruption process worked. It was something that I'd heard about in the last 10 years where I was working on other things.
So in other words, when you got had to go through this ordeal with your divorce situation, it just kind of bled into
becoming aware of the scope and magnitude of this interlocking criminal enterprise, and how I identified the role of the political extremist was that it became obvious from some of the things that were being done that somebody's agenda was being followed. And what I did was take that agenda and just, go out on the internet and match it up with political ideology. And that's what led me to Andrea Dworkin and, a number of other, if I could call it feminist philosophers, who were, responsible for such statements that all men are rapists.
So, but what I see what you're saying here is that people are being played off each other, even though it is...
it's an alliance of political... It started out as an alliance of political extremists and white-collar criminals like Nick Wilson, in state government, who, found common cause in, carrying out their agenda and lining their pockets with money.
And that you're finding that it would have to be a collusion of sorts between judges and sheriffs and prosecutors and child custody, and I mean you're finding an interlocking system that's
And I've documented over time how the agenda has migrated into areas where you would not expect to find it. People don't understand that judges operate on two sets of operating instructions, if you could think of it in those terms. One is, the state and federal code, and the other is judicial policy manuals. They're either called bench guides or bench books, depending on which state you're in. And I documented in one case where one of these advocacy operations, which was ostensibly a nonprofit foundation, had succeeded in producing a bench book that contained instructions for judges to consider the amount of federal funds that would be pulled into the state by placing a child in state custody rather than parental custody. So they were essentially instructing judges to consider the financial interests of the state in determining child custody.
Okay, let me go ahead and say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody. And my guest this evening is James Roger Brown, and he's runs the website, the Sociology Center at which is the www.thesociologycenter.com, and he's been investigating child protective services. Is that correct?
Well, that's one aspect of what I do. I do also work in other areas, particularly intelligence collection and analysis methodology. I've developed a system for collecting and analyzing intelligence that's more sophisticated than any of the alphabet agencies in the federal government. I can tell you about one of those since it's incorporated in the book, the manual on for determining the best interest of the child. The reason for the high error rate in the criminal justice system is how they analyze evidence. Everybody, pretty much, whether you realize it or not, uses some kind of hypothesis testing in making decisions and determining if information is true or false. in the scientific arena, it's the scientific process, which involves null hypothesis testing. The police and judicial system and the intelligence agencies have been using contrary hypothesis testing. The logical properties of contrary hypotheses are that all cannot be true, but all can be false. And the easiest example to relate to on that is, you know, if you've got five suspects for a murder, you only have a chance at identifying the guilty party correctly if it's one of the suspects that you've identified. Now, if the person, you know, who's not in the pool is actually guilty, and the police are under pressure to nail somebody for it, they, you know, would end up prosecuting whoever the facts fit with least distortion, and that's why you have a growing example of people who've been in prison for decades that were falsely convicted because the police were not using a hypothesis testing that had a high reliability rate.
And it's not in, and it's not into their favor to do so either, then, because they,
no,
they have to keep up their census.
For two reasons. You know, it's a tradition now, and, you know, it's become, that's the way it's always been done attitude. What I developed, identified and developed is contradictory hypothesis testing. And again, using the example of, you know, criminal suspects, if you look at each one individually and test the hypothesis, this person is guilty, this person is not guilty, then you have, more reliable way of analyzing the evidence, because the properties of contradictory hypothesis testing are that both cannot be true, both cannot be false. You know, the person has to be either guilty or not guilty. And, you know, you if you have five suspects and you use that method for analyzing the evidence, you would be more likely to conclude that you know, all five of these people were not guilty and that you needed to look for somebody else. Another aspect of this is because, you know, using the contradictory hypothesis testing, you know, and there are only two possibilities. If evidence is put forth supporting both that the person is guilty and the person is not guilty, you immediately know that one set of evidence has been falsified. And I've developed more analytical tools to use on that, and can actually render visible attempts at evidence falsification, professional misconduct, evidence tampering, you know, a whole set of additional information can be revealed by using contradictory hypothesis testing over contrary.
Okay, is anybody picking this up and utilizing that? That's doing this in any of these systems?
All I can tell you is that I've found very few people interested in actually finding out the truth, other than individuals who are trying to defend themselves. Every case that I have worked on that went to trial, in which I used the tools I've developed to analyze the evidence, resulted in not guilty verdicts. Now, there were other cases that were, you know, where the either the state agency making the prosecution attempt, or the prosecutor, when they saw the writing on, you know, where this was headed, they literally dropped it. And in one case, I was actually on the witness stand testifying about how the MMPI-2 was rigged to produce false positives. And when the attorney representing the Child Protective Service Agency realized where this was headed, he suddenly jumped up and objected to me testifying at this hearing that it would be more appropriate for another hearing later on. And there was never another hearing because they dropped the charges against the man.
Okay, are you finding anybody else that's wanting to learn this program so that they can use it out there for some of these other people that are being accused? Because from my understanding is that the hands are often tied to the parents when you get some of these agencies involved, and they don't even often, like you were saying, that they were taking off with these kids into another state, or they had almost no way to fight back.
Well, I have developed a friendship of some degree with a judge, a progressive and intelligent judge here in Kentucky, who has used what I've developed in applying it to cases. He works on and assisted me in contacting a judge's organization to try and get them to consider, using this, adopting it as the method for analyzing evidence for hearings. But, it was either beyond them or they didn't want to put the effort into making the changes in the system. I have done other things. I've filed, for example, a Federal Trade Commission deceptive trade practices complaint regarding the MMPI-2 and other tests being rigged to produce false positives. That's a violation of deceptive trade practices, both in federal code and state code. And I would encourage anyone who's ever taken the MMPI-2 or other tests that can be determined to suffer the same flaws to also file a deceptive trade practices complaint with the State Attorney General's office. They're the ones responsible for consumer protection. That's the tools I've developed for people working in their own states to try and get changes done, because this is clearly putting forth a test that purports to diagnose the presence or absence of psychological disorders when it only in fact concludes that everyone has psychological disorders. That's not a diagnostic test.
Okay, so in your observation, this is pretty much across the board in most of the states, because they all pretty much use the same system, right?
Yes.
Okay, now, do you have any idea how many kids are being put into this system that shouldn't even be there at all? Like, per state?
Well, I can tell you that because of the fraud element and the both of the corrupting mechanisms, commission and fraudulent mechanisms built into the contracting process for filing the claims, all of the government statistics on child abuse in the United States are worthless. Nobody out there has the information to determine how many people are, how many children are actually being abused. My estimate is that the true number is probably in the 1-3% range of children that actually are abused by their parents. But I've even gone to the length of contacting the state coroner's office to try and factor out whether children died in state custody or in parental custody. And nobody's collecting that information. They just recorded a dead kid and don't do much about developing data on the factors that produce their death.
Okay, now, but you were saying that there was a very high percentage of the kids saying that they had been molested in this. So are they all...
Well, those were the ones that were taken into the foster care system.
Oh, okay.
You know, that virtually all of them end up being abused and molested. But it's the children taken into state custody that have the exceedingly high, abuse and molestation rate.
Okay, so but they have to know who the people are that are doing the abusing, and the ones that are the good ones have to know who they are as well, right? And is this not being reported?
You've got to remember that this is about making money, and the more foster parents you have, the more children you can get into the system. And in fact, one of the problems they have is recruiting enough foster parents to process the number of kids they have to take in to meet their quota and commissions.
So the good ones are then now allowing the other ones to exist.
Well, the only thing I can tell you about that is that I was contacted by two parties interested in reform. One was a social worker who was sickened by the destruction these extremists were working on his profession. He had retired, and he asked me what could be done to fix the system. And I gave him a list of what needed to be done. He took it to the licensing board. And remember, this is a man who's within the profession. He took it to the state licensing board, and they told him that they couldn't do anything about it. And the other group that is responsive to your question was a group of foster parents that were trying to form an organization of foster parents to reform the system. Well, what happened is that they were all penalized, and in some cases, some of them, with leadership positions, were kicked out of the foster care system entirely.
So is there somebody skimming off the top that's involved in this, that's at the top that can control this?
Well, again, I can give you an example. I have only encountered one honest person that was still in a child protection system agency and in a management position. They told me that they lived in constant fear for their life.
Now, do you run into that situation for yourself?
I'm sorry?
Do you run into that situation for yourself at all because you're exposing some of this in these cases?
Yes, but it's a mixture. I've worked in the intelligence arena in ways that have offended a number of people for a number of reasons. Yes, I am hated by a substantial number of people for several reasons. There have been attempts to discredit me, discredit my business. For example, when I first opened the Sociology Center in 1996 and moved my office to a new location, someone distributed flyers at the airport with my phone number on it, my new phone number, indicating that it was an executive escort service.
So, but ultimately that should have been relatively easy to get. It was just a hassle for you, right?
Yeah, it was just a hassle. It was harassment. To my knowledge, none of the attempts to close my file with extreme prejudice, which there have been eight, were a product of the child protection system information I've developed.
They were for other reasons, then, is what you
Yes.
Saying. Okay. So as far as if you were a parent and had this take place to you, what kind of suggestions would you give to these people on how to deal with it since they have to go through this corrupted process?
Well, first off, you need to understand that you're dealing with organized crime. You know, this isn't about your rights. You need to get an attorney. One of the books that I have available on my website is a proactive defense strategy that steps and forms you can use before getting involved, getting sucked into the system that will make you a less desirable target. If you wait till after you've been sucked into the system, you are really going to get hurt because it's going to cost you money for legal representation. And, you know, it's one area where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Okay, so where in the process is it where they need to do this? Because how do they know? I mean, sometimes it just happens, like you said, they pick them up on a Friday and they're stuck in the system already.
Yeah. Well, it's all structured in such a way that, you know, once the allegation is made, the first thing that goes is your parental rights. Because, you know, if you're suspect for abuse and the state is now the protector of your child, one of the tools that I have in the proactive family defense manual is a card that you fill out and laminate. It has the child's name on it, and the child is taught and you know, rehearsed on handing that card to school administrators, police, you know, any authority figure that starts asking questions about the family or, you know, for example, wanting the child to take his clothes off to be photographed to see if he have bruises or something on him. The card invokes all of the child's rights separate from the parental rights. So that even if, you know, if the parental rights go by the wayside and the child hands them this card invoking his rights, then they're on notice that they have to do something differently because it specifically says that, you know, the child wants his parents and or family attorney present.
So, have you been able to help? You saying that are you getting a good response?
Yeah, that card. I've been told on at least two occasions where the card seemed to help. I've not had a lot of feedback on that, but it is out there, and some people have used it. You know, the problem is that a lot of people think, well, you know, I'm not abusing my child, I'm not doing anything wrong, nobody's going to come after me, and you know, by the time they wake up to what's happening, it's too late, and they've already been sucked into the system. I can give you an example of how easily that can happen and add to, you know, ongoing family tragedies that are medically related. My niece had leukemia, and a teacher at school reported that, you know, the child had apparent bruises on them, and they were investigated for possible child abuse.
Are you familiar with the case of Greg Pound in Florida?
Greg Pound?
Right.
I don't recall that name at the moment.
Okay. Well, and I've just heard him do a number of interviews, but he speaks of, you know, having a child with a dog bite and taking them to the hospital, and I can't remember the reason that he ended up having to take the child to the hospital, but once that started the ball rolling, he ended up losing all of his kids, and even one that was unborn, they were after they had to leave the state. I mean, these kind of things can just kind of steamroll, and
yes.
And are you up on any instances like this?
Well, I don't recall that incident specifically, but you know, there are examples of parents who, I think in California there was actually a wine manufacturer, you know, wine producer, who for some reason got afoul of the system, and it cost him $500,000 to you know, fight off the child abuse charge. And I think his was a lot of times these occur in divorce settings where, you know, what I discovered was that the attorneys actually instruct, especially the women, to be the first one to file the abuse complaint against the other party, because they, you know, whoever files the child, the complaint first, usually ends up getting custody of the child.
That's what I hear too. Yeah. And so, and that's almost impossible to defend once that ball's rolling.
Right.
And so,
and you know, and it's very easy to get going because all of the, you know, they keep adding to the list of people that are mandated reporters, and the, you know, the consequences of for the required mandating reporters if there's any incident that they don't report that could even remotely be construed as indicating that there's some abuse, if they subsequently, you know, someone determines that the child was abused or molested and they didn't report it, then they could end up going to prison. So, you know, if you're in that position, all your incentives are to, you know, report everyone who comes in your door as a potential abuser or molester, just to cover your own legal backside.
Well, you know, one of the things you're talking about getting a lawyer, and yet these guys work within the same system that the judges and
yes,
are,
and that,
right?
Is part of the problem. You know, because they're not going to go all out for you being a client, because after you're gone, you're just in their life for a short period of time, and because of the profession they're in, you know, they're going to have to work with these judges and other attorneys after you're gone. So they're not going to go out of the way to the point where they're going to offend somebody that's going to
be deciding
their
cases
in their life in the future.
Yeah.
And you know, even other attorneys could potentially become judges, and you know, if they hate your innards for something you've done in the past, then they're going to rule against you out of spite.
So when you first brought up this situation among the people that made the statements that you opened up the program with, what you were alluding to was somewhat of the fact that you had some movements that were being developed that would subterfuge the family.
I can tell you what some of the organizations are, and these are terms they use to describe themselves. If you do a Google search for female supremacists, lesbian separatists, and these are really a weird bunch of folks. They believe that lesbians are genetically superior, and they want to set up you know, get rid of everybody else and set up a lesbian utopia. And in both the male and female homosexual movement, at one point there was a political movement for getting cloning declared as a reproductive right for the gay. And their logo, if you remember, the first sheep that was cloned was called Dolly. Mm-hmm. This was years ago. Their logo was a sheep in a lotus position, and it was the Dalai Lama.
Oh, gosh. Now, but let me kind of explore this a little bit, because this is something that I'm observing in many other avenues, because so many of us are being played off of one faction or another. They find some way to divide us and find some way to...
Before you ask me that, let me give you the name of the largest group that I discovered. And when I first ran across these, there were only like four websites, I think, and now there's hundreds, as the Lesbian Avengers.
But, okay, this again is where, when I'm finding it in your voting process or whatever, it's like they find and create these things, even though there may be legitimate people out there that have joined this, but as a rule, it's like somebody else is funding and pushing that to drive a wedge between no matter what type of campaign's going on. Now, Grant, and ultimately, if it's true that this sort of the trafficking is going on, I'll guarantee those are not the people that are pulling the strings. They may be involved, but they're not the ones at the top that are putting the kibosh on any kind of investigation. And that's why I hate to get caught up into some of that, even though I know it may exist. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, and I can I can tell you that, you know, part of the motives at the level that this is occurring, like, you know, Senator Nick Welsing, you know, he at the time was the most powerful member of the legislature, and you know, if he wanted to stop an investigation of some sort that would have revealed his own personal shenanigans in the child protection system, you know, he certainly would have stopped it. So I think there are some, you know, capabilities for stopping potential embarrassing developments at that level.
Okay, now take a look at.
I know from some of my other research that there are other organizations out there with malicious intent that have a great deal of financial resources and my term for it is are pursuing evil agendas.
Okay, before we get any further, I want to again bring up the fact that we're doing a membership drive with Cahen, and if Dan wants to again speak up a little bit on what we're doing here. And
okay, if you're listening right now, you enjoy this program and others on your community radio station, KHENLP 106.9 in Salida. Cahen is listener-supported radio, which means that your support is what allows us to exist. If you believe that community radio is important, give us a call tomorrow when the station's open from 9 to 1 and become a member, or renew your existing membership with Cahen 106.9 FM. You can also pledge your membership on our website, www.khen.org.
And while we're at it, you know, there may be some other people volunteering during the live program tomorrow afternoon after Magda, who's here from 9 to 1. And so please feel free to, you know, come in and say hi. And if you have a membership you want to join, we've got membership applications here and or re-up and renew your membership. So please feel free to do so either through our website at khen.org or give us a call tomorrow between 9 and 1 for sure. And we have live programming throughout the day, and they will have volunteers coming in taking the pledges. So, James, I hope I don't forget what I was wanting to say here. I know what it was, because I've interviewed Kevin Annett, and he's been very, very involved with with church organizations between the Catholic Church and another major Canadian church in Canada that has been very involved with the Indigenous people up there who have been put through the system, the child protection systems, or put in homes and been abused and or did not even survive the stay while they were there. I know they have the same sort of thing going on in this country, and there's been a worldwide movement to bring it to the forefront on some of the things that had been taking place among priesthood in the Catholic Church. Are you running across any of this sort of thing in your research?
Well, you know, certainly the history of the relationship with Native Americans here in the United States involves what you might describe as the do-gooder movement, who thought that the children should be removed from their Native American parental custody and sent to schools that taught them to be civilized. I think both the Canadian government and the United States government, to some extent, has apologized for doing that, but certainly, you know, still, again, for federal funding, the incentives, the, you know, Native American population is certainly a target also. The added factor there is, I think, the tribal officials can rake off some of the money, but I'm not absolutely sure. I know that in some cases where Native American children have gotten into trouble, the judicial system has recognized tribal punishments for criminal activity. I think it was in Alaska, there was a teenager essentially exiled to live alone on an island for a year for some offense he had committed. Don't recall exactly what it was, but there is some recognition of, Native rights. In some cases, like the Pamunkey and Mattapani Indians in Virginia, it's because there were pre-existing treaties with the state prior to becoming part of the United States. So those territories are actually recognized as small independent nations. They could even set up their own diplomatic relations with foreign countries if they so desired. So there's a wide range of possibilities and circumstances with regard to the Native American population in the United States.
Well, one of the things that we found among these groups is that there was, they had the adoption, which, that could be a sizable form of money to come in with these kids, other than just having the foster parent situation, which I don't recall him bringing in foster parent that scenario into his particular instance, because that's what he's been focusing on, is how they had taken these children into these homes and literally abused them and used them for like lab rats and various other ways, because you've got a an isolated group that, you know, would be perfect for that sort of thing if they wanted to do experimentation.
Oh, yeah. There were cases, I think, several instances within the last decade in New York where it was revealed that children in orphanages and Catholic within the Catholic Church were used to test drugs on, you know, by pharmaceutical companies in a deal with the Catholic Church.
So, again, coming back to the fact of how these parents can fight or defend themselves against this, or are they pretty much helpless? Where do they go and what can they do? Is there any organizations, is there anybody out there that's really reaching out to these parents that are getting caught up in this?
Well, probably the largest organization currently out there is the American Family Rights Association. It's called AFRA. I happen to be on the board of directors for that. So I'll disclose that as fair warning. There have been in the past other organizations that have become less effective and shrunk in some cases because of political infighting. But in terms of looking out for your rights once you're sucked into the system, your best bet is an attorney. Now, in terms of prevention, you're going to have to get politically active and do something within each state about getting the Attorney General to go after these psychological tests that are rigged to produce false positives, and you can do that by filing deceptive trade practices complaints. Also,
aren't those tests also being used for hiring practices and stuff?
Oh, it's used for all kinds of things. Screening law enforcement candidates. Now, I've talked to a number of people in various, commercial enterprises and things that have used this, and they generally consider it worthless, but nobody knows why. During the entire history of the MMPI-2, there was an MMPI-1, that was created in the late 40s. Nowhere in all of the literature regarding the mental health profession and psychological testing, no one prior to me has ever done a logic analysis of the interpretive structure. And I attribute that.
No logic on logic.
I'm sorry?
No logic on logic.
I attribute that in part to the attitude, demonstrated in the two quotes from Sigmund Freud. These are essentially people that come from an arrogant root that consider themselves, better than anyone else. And that's also reflected in the attitude of the caseworkers and social workers who, think that they have special powers. Some of the caseworkers at one point actually claimed that they could identify child molesters by looking at them.
Now, one of the other things that I've heard come up numerous times is some of these guys are given bonuses.
Yeah, there's all kinds of financial incentives. Now, I don't know what the particular structures are in any circumstance. They may be including bonuses in the contracts now for the third parties that process the grant and reimbursement claims. That wouldn't surprise me. Certainly getting your contract renewed would be an important factor if you wanted to continue making money and you were a private contractor, providing those services.
So if you're the average citizen and you wanted to, and you weren't sucked up into the system with the kids, how would a person in a community start becoming aware? Do they need some kind of like a people maybe going, sitting in on some of these court sessions or watching? Is there?
Oh yes, I would encourage everyone to go sit in court and watch proceedings. A lot of the child juvenile court proceedings are closed, which is unfortunate. But it's a real education to go watch the judicial system in action and see what passes for reasonable conduct in court and some of the outrageous decisions that are made.
Is there any way to review the process, even if you're not allowed to be in court, to review how many and who is the one passing these kids through and anybody else being able to look into that process?
The only way I know to do that would be to go through the court records and actually look at the case files. The problem is that
they were falsifying
a lot of child-related information is confidential, even if it's a factor in court proceedings. There are a number of books out there on the excesses of the child protection system. I don't recall any offhand, but I do have a bibliography in the Congressional Evidence Book of books related to problems with the child protection system. And I'm certain if you go to your local library and talk to a research librarian, they can help you find books on false child abuse allegation problems. It might behoove you to become familiar with your state child protection system laws. And, certainly you would want to be aware of if you're doing something that could be construed as child abuse. So a little education in that area. Certainly you can take a look at the publications on my shopping cart page.
Is there a child advocacy type organizations out there that operate anywhere?
Well, there's an Association of Survivors of the Child Protection System. I think there are some national foster parents organizations, victims of the child protection system. Like the American Family Rights Association, there are state chapters on those. I think if you probably went on the internet and did a Google search for your state and, false child abuse allegations, it would probably turn up some information specific to your state.
Okay, now one other thing that I want to bring up, and when you're doing this screening process, and that these guys, I don't know, who are they testing when they're doing these MMPIs? Are they testing the kids?
Well, they're court-ordered, usually.
Of the parents.
The psychological evaluations are court-ordered. Okay. Yeah, whether you're going through a divorce proceeding or a child abuse allegation, which includes other tests like a penile sphenography, I believe it was called, where they actually hook a sensor up to your member and show you pictures on a screen of various and sundry things, and they're supposed to be able to glean your sexual orientation and what excites you specifically.
This is they consider a legitimate test.
Well, I think it's becoming less used now, but at one time it was a hot thing. One of the things I wanted to do was run over some of the specific examples of how the MMPI-2 is rigged to produce false positives so people can be aware of what to look for. And what you need to do is, if you're taking any psychological test, is ask the person if there's, first and foremost, is there any set of answers I can give that would be interpreted as indicating I have no psychological disorders? If they give you a bunch of mumbo jumbo and don't answer yes or no, that should be a red flag. But here's a specific example.
But how do you opt out of it either? You know?
I'm sorry?
How would you opt out of it if it was ordered?
Well, I would object, first of all, that it's, you know, deceptive trade practices. You know, you're becoming a victim of deceptive trade practices by being forced to participate in something that's going to indicate, falsely indicate, that you have some disorder, because it's not possible for it to indicate that you have none. How the test works is that you're given a statement which you have to indicate is either true or false, and it's scored by increasing the score on various and sundry tests, scales, or which are groups of questions. And if you answer true, you're increased on one or more sets of scales, and if you answer false, you're increased in another set of scales. And here's an example. This is item number 29. At times, I feel like swearing. You know, who hasn't? Okay. Now, if you answer true, your score is incremented on the CS anger scale. If you answer false, okay, your score is increased on the L scale, the K scale, the S2 depression scale, the S3 hysteria scale, the over-controlled hostility scale, the social responsibility scale. Okay, so if you answer true, you know, you're headed for anger management. If you answer false, your score is increased on six other scales. You know, if you go to a doctor and tell him that you have a temperature, you know, he sticks in some thermometer somewhere, and you know, you either have a 98.6 temperature or below or above, and you can tell, you know, whether or not you've got a normal temperature or high or low. But these things are worthless because they don't diagnose anything. And it's literally impossible for you to not
ultimately
get results indicating that you have psychological problems.
Okay, in other words, they find out how to manipulate you. And this
the manipulation is built into the way the responses are interpreted by increasing the score on multiple scales for either answer.
Okay, now my...
And some of the other questions, I can give you an example. They look innocuous. You know, if I could get into a movie without paying and be sure I was not seen, I would probably do it. Sometimes in elections, I vote for people about whom I know very little. You know, those seem to be innocuous questions. And you know, the obvious scientific question is, what is the causal relationship? You know, what would cause you to answer one way or another? What mental disorder would cause you to answer one way or another to the statement, at times I feel like swearing? You know, there's actually a set of requirements for establishing causal relationships, and none of which are met in how these tests are scored.
Okay, now one of the things that I wanted to get, ask about on this too is, do they ever single out certain vulnerable parental groups, or do they ever single out kids looking for specific types of kids, like they're shopping for certain kids?
Oh yes, single parents, male or female, soldiers, especially deployed soldiers. You know, they're vulnerable for being absentee parents, and in a number of cases, you know, soldiers deployed, both male and female, have had their children seized, and they're easy targets because, you know, if they're deployed, they can't be present to fight against it. They have to, if they can even afford it, hire an attorney to represent them in absentia.
or if you've got people that have had some sort of a background where, you know, where they're trying to, you know, get their life back together or whatever, do they make, they end up being more vulnerable to being, having their kids taken and making the situation worse for them?
Well, that to some extent depends on the political ideology being followed by the individual caseworker or social worker who conducts the investigation.
Now, and how about having rogue caseworkers that just seem to have, be the ones that are just, you know, they have an exorbitant amount of kids going through the system compared to the other ones?
Well, I don't know that that's possible because, you know, they all have essentially a quota that they have to meet.
Yeah, but now, if they get bonuses, they would be, you know, that might be a indicator or whatever. And that's, I mean, you know, this is what I'm hearing out there. I'm not up on this, but I'm just saying this is some of the information I'm hearing from others that are researching this sort of thing.
Well, that's entirely possible. You know, I produced this, you know, with from 12 years research that ended, you know, when I wrote this book for the put everything together for the hearing, and you know, that was in 2004.
And the hearing was
in 2004.
No, I mean, what was the hearing? Which hearing?
The hearings held by Joe Baca.
Okay.
In California.
Okay. And your website again is thesociologycenter.com or www.
Yes, www.thesociologycenter.com. And to get to the information on the child protection system, and especially the comparable Vertinkinder scandal in Switzerland, on the first page, you would go down to the and select special research projects, and then on that page, there's some boxes down at the bottom, one of which is the Child Slave Trade Project.
Okay, I'm trying to see that, and I'm not seeing special research project. Oh, I see it. Okay, all right, right. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little further down. And some of them may be interested in, I've done a substantial amount of political commentary and analysis, and those are on the Internet Bibliography button on the first page.
And one of the tabs here, it says the Unexplained Missing Persons Project. What is that?
That's something that grew out of information I developed in my intelligence research. When you subtract out all of the, among the people who disappear every year and are never heard of again, if you subtract out the ones who have, you know, some possible explanation, you know, criminal connection, they had reason to flee for financial obligations or bad social situations, whatever. There's a stable number of people with no identifiable reason for disappearing who vanish every year. And the few intelligence people and police officers who noticed this and started collecting information on it were ordered to stop.
Okay.
So I have been attempting to find other people with information or databases that might have this. I intend to do some more intense research in that area myself, but I'm tied up with some family responsibilities right now. I'm taking care of my 90-year-old mother, and you know, when that ends, I plan to get back to some of my priority projects.
Okay.
That being one of them.
Okay, and James, I want to thank you for. Is there anything else that you would like to cover briefly before we come to bring this to an end?
Oh, I have tons of other stuff, but you know, I would encourage people to go and read the Congressional Evidence book on my website. It has, you know, pretty much everything I uncovered. And the important thing about it is that I not only show what I found, but how I found it. So you can take this and do the same research in your state and document, you know, whether it's the same situation or somewhat different. But I include how the system works and how I found out about it.
Okay, and for those that are having to challenge the system, you're saying their best bet is to be able to head it off before it ever gets started because it's
yes.
really pretty tough
and,
to challenge.
And again, this is an area where I apparently have done the only work on it. Pretty much all of the organizations that have existed and currently exist are for dealing with people once they get sucked into the system. What I did was adapt corporate proactive legal defense strategies to strategies that families can use before they get sucked into the system that make them more, less desirable targets. By invoking their rights, it includes model legal forms for placing with schools and other places outside the home where the child would be invoking your rights prior to any event. And this isn't something I developed out of whole cloth. I worked with several attorneys across the United States developing this.
And if people, you know, contacted you, would you know of any attorneys that are, you know, that you feel worthy of really working in this avenue in their favor?
There is a specific organization in Holland, Ohio. It's the National Child Abuse Defense Resource Center. They hold seminars every year training attorneys how to defend against false child abuse allegations, and they keep a database of attorneys who have attended their courses. So if you're in a particular state and you contact them, they can probably guide you to an attorney or attorneys in your vicinity who have taken their training on defending against false child abuse allegations.
Well, again, I want to thank you, James Roger Brown. And your website is www.thesociologycenter.com. And I'm sure we'll be doing another interview here again. But you have some other interests, and so I'm sure we'll cover some other subjects. But if again, we'll have this archived on our website at www.givemesometruth.info. So I want to thank.
Let me go ahead and give you my email address
okay.
and phone number. The email address is really hard to remember. It's thesociologist@roadrunner.com. thesociologist. thesociologist@roadrunner.com. And my phone number is 606-836-7613. And thank you very much for having me on.
Okay, and thank you. Good night.
Good night.